Hello everyone, welcome to our second episode of Hablar and Chill in English. I'm here with my co-host Rodrigo. What's up, Rodrigo?
Good, everything's fine. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you very much. And we have an esteemed guest of high honor, Jacobo Palomero. Please present yourself.
Well, thank you, Ronnie. Thank you, Rodrigo, for inviting me to this podcast. I'm Jacobo Palomero, and I studied international business and history in San Luis University, in the same university as you were there. Yeah. And this is my third podcast, so I'm nervous, and this is not my native language, so let's see how it goes.
It's none of our native language, but I think we'll manage. So, today's topic is going to be American hegemony, global hegemony over the last 100 years, I would say, especially since the end of World War II. And this topic is of interest because, especially with coronavirus, with the global pandemic that we're living in today, a lot of the trending topics that one would see on the news are the rise of China or how global power dynamics between nations will shift in the future. So it's important to recap how we got here and what the world has been like for the last, since World War II, I would say. Jacobo, do you think that's a good place to start, the end of World War II, and why?
Yeah, it's a really good place to start because the United States got rid of their financial crisis from 1929, thanks to the Second World War, and to be victorious, of course, because if the Germans would have won, it would be a problem for them. But yeah, certainly to get rid of that financial crisis was the beginning of the new era of United States to get their world dominance in terms of the military and in terms of economy. And in terms of economy as well. So Rodrigo, help me out
Absolutely. So I agree that the US really becomes a global powerhouse after World War II, but I don't fully agree that that's the beginning, the start of it. I would place that rather in the period after the First World War, because up until then, really, Europe was the European nations were really the dominant nations. They were still empires at the time that ruled the world. And then after World War II, all these empires collapsed and many of its colonies gained independence. Others were transferred to other empires. But it really, I think it, and also the U.S. involvement in the First World War marked its beginning as a global powerhouse, really, which then after World War II, it was confirmed and actually became the world's powerhouse, I would say.
I agree. U.S. international involvement wasn't relevant at all, wasn't impactful at all until World War II, I would say. But the reason I initially mentioned the end of World War II is because the US was quite literally feeding half the world after World War II and in charge of much of the reconstruction, especially in Europe. So in terms of economy and financial reach and control, I would say it is the beginning, so to speak, especially since you mentioned that European empires and European dominance, the dominance of certain European nations was on the decline. And then during and after World War II, it was almost completely ruined. I mean, that's why the period was followed by movements of decolonization and the independence of all their colonies because they couldn't maintain those anymore.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me change my statement. So after World War II, that marks the beginning of the US as the world hegemon. And the First World War, then we will call it a prequel.
Prequel. Yeah, that could be one. Yeah, but what is interesting about the US is what Ronnie said, after the war, they did an interesting thing with the Marshall Plan. Like to transfer over $12 billion of that time, that for you to know is like equivalent to $130 billion of nowadays, which is a lot of money. But the interesting thing is that they made Europe productive again. And it was kind of a new colonization because they wanted to make Europe again productive in order to have an income, an average income in terms of society in order to create more consumption. The interesting thing is that that consumption was most of it American products. So it was a way to consolidate a new market, a huge market in Europe. Mm-hmm. And also conflicts like Korea, Vietnam, trying to establish like the Western economic perspective in Asia. It was kind of a try to establish a new economic market there, like they did in Japan. So I think, as you both said, like the end of the Second World War is the really beginning of the US hegemony, and also as Rodrigo said, like the fall of the empires in Europe was like the trigger that the US has become what it is now. Because otherwise, without the First World War, Rodrigo is right, United States, it wouldn't be what it is today. It could be in terms of wealth, but it would be impossible to have the influence that they have right now without the First World War.
It's interesting because as political science students, me and Rodrigo especially, we learn typically that the world was bipolar during the Cold War, meaning that there were two big powers, mainly the USSR and the United States. But I don't buy it. You know, they were never going to go to war to each other with each other, and the US was much more powerful. I don't subscribe to that perspective, and in typical political science theory, well, the US hegemony begins with the collapse of the Soviet Union. I just don't buy it. I mean, they when you look at the declassified documents from the post World War II period, where they're literally planning what to do with the global system, and that is visible in things like the Bretton Woods Conference, which was a conference where ideas were exchanged on how to proceed with the financial system, and then later on with the Nixon shock, where gold was officially thrown in the garbage, and they implemented a free floating exchange rate system. So there's good grounds to make the case that US hegemony begins post World War II, I would say. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about how they actually did it. I'd like to get the financial side of it out from the beginning. And many scholars have written on this, but they've done a good job at establishing what's called in economics automatic stabilizers. So the dollar is the most and has been the most trusted currency because of various reasons, primarily the link to energy. So oil, everything's traded and bought and sold in dollars. Plus the global chain of military bases, the automatic stabilizers function in such a way. So Japan when there's a recession in the US, when something doesn't go according to plan, well, Japan does well and Germany does well. This is how the US can maintain such a massive budget deficit, because they suck in all the capital from these countries. So Japan and Germany always have a surplus in terms of trade, because they are export-oriented economies. And these surpluses have to get invested somewhere, and they get invested in the New York Stock Exchange. And that's why, for example, today, China is the one financing the US deficit, because they have a surplus of dollars, because they export globally, but the US is a massive trading partner. And they have a surplus of dollars, and those dollars, they buy government bonds with those. And so it's a global system which functions in such a way that they act as automatic stabilizers. And that's the general thought process behind why it's been so stable, why American dominance has been so stable from the financial perspective. But maybe Jacobo can enlighten us on the military perspective.
Well, I'm agree, but the military perspective is actually pre-related with the economical one, because during the Second World War, like, the main reason why the United States won the war is because of the resources and the production system. During the war, production was increased at levels never seen in the world. So they took advantage of that industry that evolved during the war, after the war. So that was like the main engine of the country, to create products. All these companies that manufactured bullets, cannons, or tanks, they were used in order to produce now other kinds of guns, which were products that people in Europe and people in the US and people in Japan could buy. And that is a way to keep the hegemony of the United States, rather than in the military, also in the economy. So I'm pretty agree with Ronnie in that. Also, like, United States has accomplished a good matter in terms of the military by owning the seas. They have the major fleet in the world in order to control the exports, which they give them power. And also to have a military presence in whenever they need, which they have used over the last 70 years. Like we said, in Korea, Vietnam, and in the 90s in the Middle East. And they have done a really good job in terms of creating that massive economic engine. But the real thing is, for me, the most important one in terms of exports in the US is the Marshall Plan, because making Europe productive again and profitable is a good way in order to create a new middleman class that could spend more money in this importing products from the US. And that, for me, is like the main reason why the United States have established their hegemony in the world, because whatever place they go, they establish their businesses, such as McDonald's.
Yeah.
In every single country.
And they rely on them. Europe relies on the US. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it the US that convinced France to agree to give Germany debt relief? All the debt?
Yeah, because they learned from the First World War.
Yeah.
In the First World War, the France actually pushed the other countries to pressure Germany in their economic bankruptcy. That's the reason why the Second World War started.
Yes.
And the Second War started, because Germany was so fucked up. Sorry about these words, about their economy. And France actually took the regions of the Ruhr in order to take their raw materials. So that, and the Americans knew about this. We're not going to fuck up the Germans again, because it could happen a third time, you know? So they did it in a peaceful way and in a smart way. let the Germans become Americans in a sense. Let the Germans actually spend their money in buying American products. Let the French spend in an American product. And that is the reason. And this is a kind of colonization, but in terms of business rather than an invasion. It's kind of a business invasion. And that was a really smart idea by the Americans. And you can see right now, everyone, like Rodrigo is talking with an Apple laptop. How many German Apple laptops we got? Like the Germans, they only do the products that they have done for 100 years. The cars, the heavy industry thing, but all the innovation, the Germans are really innovative. I'm not saying that, but the all the innovation and all that is in the US. And most of their products are from the US and they're exporting them. And another thing I want to say, and with this I conclude and I let you talk, is like the United States after the war, they make a great thing. And we're part of it, actually. The universities, they took all the human capital of the world and they made them Americans. They take the best people in the world and actually... and make them be American citizens. And that is a really, really intelligent idea. Let's get all the human capital from the rest of the world and let them make American citizens in order to create wealth in the United States. And man, that was the best idea I think the United States have done, because they have created a multicultural country with a lot of ideas, a lot of investment, and they have generated a great system of wealth in terms of businesses. And that is one of the main reasons why they have their hegemony in the world.
I agree. And that has to do with the global financial system and the capital flows between countries. So a lot of the, like I said, a lot of the surpluses of the main exporting countries in the world ends up in the United States. So naturally they're getting a lot of investment from that. And it's the main reason they don't care about having a deficit and things like that. On the military perspective, I think the reason it's called the military industrial complex is because it's absolutely fundamental to the US economy. And one example of that is that Lockheed Martin was bailed out by the government more than 20 times. It was on the verge of bankruptcy. They have to maintain these industries because it's a way of convincing some people like Chomsky or Varoufakis, or one would call extreme left wing, perhaps. It's not a categorization I'm fond of. But it's a way of convincing the public to invest in high technology through the military. So that's why, I mean, and there is no, this is the function it serves. It's not some kind of, nobody admitted to this, not that I know of at least, but it's the function that it serves. And that's why we see that Americans average a big war every 20 years. They always need a new enemy. They always need new technology. And it's a way, and some of the technology that's visible to us from military expenditure are the weapons, obviously. But the technology that arises that's not so visible because it's not as direct is all the technology that we're seeing come out, as you were saying, with Apple and with other companies. What they do is they take... public funds that went to research and they appropriate a product and they reinvent it in such a way to make to manufacture a product and they sell it. And this was a trend that has existed for a long time. So in MIT, in other university departments where they did research, well, companies like IBM would come and copyright, appropriate the product, copyright, and make a business out of that, all of which is tax funded. So I feel like the military aspect of American hegemony is actually an ingenious way of getting the public on, in the political sense, on their side, so getting public support, and then getting the tax money to be able to continue dominating the world through technology. That combined with what you've said of foreign investments and what's known as brain drain in economics, where the experts of, from other countries come to the US, all of that makes it so much more effective. And I feel like that's why it's lasted so long, despite the horrible reputation that America has in many parts of the world. They don't care. I mean, they're the laughing stock of many countries, but they don't care. Nobody can do anything.
Well, yeah, I'm agree with you, but remember that the United States is a young country.
Yeah.
They have established their power for 80 years at global level. Let's see in the future, because as we talk in other podcasts, like empires rise and fall, it's a matter of time. But let's see how the United States in the next 20 years keep running out, because they got in the Middle East with the excuse of atomic weapons, you know, with San Jose.
Well, how first with communism, but yes, 9/11, it changed when communism.
You know what I'm talking about. Yeah. So it's really hard to start a war right now. So how you're going to keep the biggest army in the world without moving? And that is a good question, because if you don't move an army, it costs monumental amount of money. It's much profitable if you keep the army moving. That's why the United States has moved the army all the time. Mm-hmm. Research and development. And of course, they settle in a new country. They make them democratic. They establish like a middle class. You have to create a middle class in every single country in order to have consumption. And that is the most important thing. And that's what I'm talking about before with the Marshall Plan. It was excellent idea. Make Europe productive again. Let's create a new state of wealth. Social bienestar. How do you say
welfare
that?
Welfare state.
A welfare state. Let's see that every person have the same rights, has a good house, everything. And how do you pay that? Of course, with taxes. And of course, by paying corporations for their products. And most corporations during the 50s to nowadays, they are American. And that's the reason why they are such an economic empire. But nowadays, they got the problem with China, because China is like the sleeping beauty, you know? It has been like 30 years without doing shit, and now is doing the right thing. Because they're now investing in the military. They're now having huge corporations, and they're doing the same as the United States did before. But now they are buying all the raw resources from South America and Africa. So let's see how in the future.
And they learned from the American mistakes. So they have a policy of non-intervention. They don't care if there's Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe killing his own people. They don't care. They just do business, and with no political or with limited political involvement, so to speak. So they learned from that mistake, because there's a lot of reputation at stake. And for China, that matters, because they don't have this global military reach that America does, at least not yet.
Of course, and that is the thing. If they wanted to have it at the same level, a war has to start, because otherwise it's impossible. As I said, like the major fleet in the world is from the US. They have track of all the exports by sea. And that's one of the reasons why they are such a power, because if you control the sea, you control the economy. And nowadays is more importantly, because all the trade goes by sea. By plane, yeah, it goes, but only a few things. Sí, Rodrigo.
Yeah, have you heard about the Belt and Road Initiative, China?
Yeah.
So, you know, it could change. You know, all the trading might start to go by land instead of sea, you know?
And, I agree with that, but
and if, let's... if they manage to connect China with Europe via land, I mean trains, roads, whatever, and they leave the US out of it, this could change the whole global panorama.
Yeah, but let's see, because that road has to cross many countries, and it's pretty easy that one of those countries leaves a new terrorism attack, you know? So, you know what I'm talking about? It's kind of a speculation, but it's pretty difficult that they got that in a peaceful way. It's impossible, because if that happens, like, the U.S. is in a big trouble, in a big trouble.
Like, especially from cyber warfare.
Oh, cyber warfare is another thing. Yeah, of course.
It won't be a traditional war as we know it with armies on the ground. Not necessarily. The majority of the combat will be through cyber. I don't know the technical term. So yeah. Hacking electricity systems, water systems, and that's much more damaging. Chemical, biological, perhaps.
Yeah, okay, the biological, and that I agree, but this cyber war, I don't know if I completely agree with that. I mean, at the end of the day, you might be the best hacker, you might leave a town without electricity or water or whatever, but if you have boots on the ground with weapons, they are the ones who rule, you know?
I think you're underestimating the kind of damage that cyber warfare can do. I mean, water is pumped electrically.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I know Congress, I'm underestimating it. But
the American Congress put out a report not too long ago estimating that if they don't take the necessary precautions against cyber warfare, more than 70% of Americans could die in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then, the military might rule if they invaded China on the ground, but for who? Rule for who? There's nobody left.
Yeah, but you're forgetting like the major decoy of nowadays. I think that's a reason why there are not many wars as they have gone, as they have done. That is the nuclear warfare.
Yeah.
Like the United States and China, every single big nation in this world right now has a nuclear system. So that is the biggest decoy, and that is the reason why there has not been any warfare. As you mentioned with the Cold War, what is cold? Because I have nuclear weapons and you too. So if we fucked up each other, we fucked up the world.
Yeah.
And after the Second World War, actually Patton, before Stalin got the atomic bomb, he said the best idea we should do is to bombard Russia with two nuclear weapons, one in Moscow and one in Stalingrad, and we fucked up this. So there is no more war in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But Patton died in a car accident. I don't think that is, how to say,
an accident.
Now we're getting into the field of conspiracies.
I have one comment though. Like, I do agree with you that MAD, mutually assured destruction, is a real concept and it has real implications. So there's obviously an element of deterrence if both powers have nuclear weapons. But there's also another perspective that I don't see considered very often, because it's very easily delegitimized by calling it some kind of conspiracy theory, as if there's people in suits playing golf and going and talking about. No, I mean, another reason why the US and China won't go to war is because the financial system, the way it is now, they depend on each other. So, and the same with the Cold War. I mean, we can list certain events that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union, but I think that in general, they just, to simplify everything, I think they just couldn't keep up. I mean, they were having proxy wars all over, and the US was much more powerful, but the USSR had a nuke. In the case of China, I mean, there's no proxy wars now, but at one point, by law of entropy, by law of nature, one of them, one party, will not be able to keep up. China is trying to make, is taking decent strides in challenging, for example, SWIFT, every bank transaction uses a SWIFT code. SWIFT is based in Belgium, but it's obviously majority controlled by the Americans. And they're challenging that with their whole revolution of using the phone all the time and banking on the phone, and it eliminates the need for SWIFT. And this could really change everything if they succeed with that, if it becomes popular enough globally. I mean, it depends. Like, it depends. I don't know. I don't think it has to be. My point is, I don't think there has to be a war, you know? And I don't think it's that likely as well.
It is, yeah. But if you have to be effective in the long term, there has to be a war. It doesn't matter if we're living in the 21st century. Like, in history, there has been many wars. And so it would not be weird. But I think the runny aspect of the business war, I think that is the economical war, I think, is a really damn point. Because also, runny talk mentions SWIFT, but also the main point is now cryptocurrencies. I think China is supporting a lot of cryptocurrencies in order to fuck up the system. And it would not be a really, and it is a smart move, but certainly the thing is what we talk about, who controls the exports controls warfare and the economy. And nowadays the United States have the control of the exports by sea, and also has a partner that is Japan that is doing a really good job in terms of having the coastal surveillance system they're having right now. But China nowadays, they are trying to fuck up the Japanese by making artificial islands in order to keep track of the Japanese. So let's see, because it's not an easy thing. Yeah.
I don't know if I agree though, like, about the issue of does a war actually need to happen? Because yes, you can win a war, but now, consider, not because of 21st century values, human rights, that's all bullshit. Human rights are not real, in my opinion. Okay, like, they're not rights, they're not guaranteed, they're a privilege, right? And some people don't have the privilege. More because of how consumeristic the global world, like the world is now, it's more long-lasting and more effective. And in terms of, like, how effective it is, and in terms of how reputation and things like that, to win a war through economic means, because you don't just defeat militarily another nation, you cripple it forever. I mean, if you take control over the way of doing business, then there's no coming back from that. Nobody's going to buy from you. How do you get money? How do you recuperate? Whereas if you destroy American military, was maybe in banking, maybe in oil, they'll have they'll have other sources of revenue to regain. And, you know, one is more, in my opinion, more crippling than the other. Not only do you humiliate through destruction, but also you cannot come back from that. You know, one is much more permanent, I think.
It's permanent, but now we have talked about this, not in the podcast, but it's a nice way to start. And for maybe another episode, like, I think we're talking about nations, but I think nowadays it was not like in the Second World War, a nationalist perspective of how society moves. It's more now a corporate way. So corporations have the lead of the world right now. Nations don't actually have any importance anymore, because the money is so interconnected that we don't know who has the power, actually. Maybe Silicon Valley, yeah, I'm joking, but certainly the corporations have the power of the world rather than nations. So if we talk about the US, we're talking about certain, we're talking about real power, or maybe corporations have the real power of the world right now rather than nations.
Okay, but they're a bit linked in the sense that, take the big companies like Amazon, like Google, like Tesla, whatever. All these big companies, even though they're multinational and they have global reach, and for example, in lawsuits or in court, they can literally wipe their asses with a country like Australia, like Philip Morris did in one court case, for example. But since they lobby in the US, and for example, there's the phenomena of the revolving door between governments and corporations. So if you work in an industry, then you also lobby to get a position in the government. So they're also kind of tied to the US government, if you know what I mean in that sense. I'm not saying that's no indication of loyalty to the US government, but it's going to be, if they're going to use any government tools to reach an objective, it's going to be the US one for now. And in any situation that China changes that, then mm-hmm. that's where the real damage is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and China is pretty fragile in terms of their society. Mm-hmm. Like, they have huge internal problems. Most of China doesn't know what is happening in the rest of the world. so they're really constrained. And if the US, you're talking about cyber warfare, but they could make like a huge internal warfare in China. That could be a great deal.
I mean, that's happening in the US right now. And let's be honest, how many Americans are aware of global issues and things that are happening everywhere else?
But that is what I'm talking about. After the Second World War, there is no any national perspective. Okay, the US, okay, with Hollywood, the flag, whatever. But I'm talking, for example, Europe. There is no nationalistic perspective anymore. Like, if we're talking in terms of Spain, what the hell? Like, what are the views of the country? To be economically better? Okay, but we're not even reaching out. There are no leaders in Europe. And neither in the US. US is pure lobbies. Like, we're living in a world with there are no idealisms or any leadership. We're living in a world of corporation, and we're the fucking puppets. So certainly we are living in a different century than 80 years ago, like the Second World War. Like,
I agree.
The Nazis, okay, we're Nazis, but they were fighting for Germany. The English were British, and they were talking about English. But nowadays, if US go against China, I don't believe that, for example, one of the wealthiest people in America gets boring the next day. You know where I'm talking about?
I agree. Let's leave it at that and continue it in another episode. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for coming, Jacobo.
Thank you.
Rodrigo, say bye.
Hi, everybody.
Thank you, guys. See you next one.